The juror gasped as soon as the words filled the courtroom. A neighbor testified that Jennifer's stepfather said this during a neighborhood dispute several years after Jennifer Lewis's homicide.
And he said, "Come out in the road and fight to the death." He said, "If I can kill my own daughter, I can kill you because you don't mean shit to me."
Lori Gomez testified that she heard a drunken Joe Ace Glenn holler those words at their neighbor, Arnold Pappas. Pappas testified via video conferencing.
Did you, was there a date, and I believe in 1999, that you had an interaction with Mr. Glenn, is that fair?
Yeah, I guess you called them.
Okay. Were you at your house?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And you're at your house. Did Mr. Glenn show up at your house?
He come out in the street and come up in my yard.
Were you guys friends?
Not exactly.
And was he saying something to you when he was up in your yard?
He was trying to get anybody out to come out and fight. Just arguing with everyone, the entire neighborhood.
Okay. Did you want him on your property?
No, I didn't want him on my property.
Okay. At some point, did you ask him to leave?
More than once.
And so he's yelling at you, and at some point did he say something specific about what he would do?
He said he would kill all of us. He had already killed his daughter, and we didn't mean anything to him.
And you remember those words coming out of his mouth?
Yeah, they weren't quite that nice.
Since this incident happened in 1999, the juries in the 1993 and 1995 trials did not hear Pappas' testimony. But Jennifer's mother, Sherry Glenn McCormick, said she doesn't believe her neighbors.
Do you recall an incident where there was a confrontation with the Pappas, with Arnold Pappas?
Yes, I do.
Were you outside at that time?
Yes, I was.
And what happened?
The neighbors and all of us were having an argument because Jennifer's bike was stolen. And when we first moved in, some three wheel rims were stolen, and so we didn't get along with the neighbors.
Did Joe, was he in a confrontation with Arnold Pappas?
Yes, he was.
And what was Joe's condition at that time?
He was under the influence of alcohol.
How much?
Drunk, yelling stuff in the street.
If Pappas had described him as ranting and raving, would that be an accurate description?
Not that quite.
Okay. Do you recall him yelling anything about Jennifer's murder?
No.
Do you recall him saying, I killed my daughter and I can kill you?
He would never say that.
But then things became odd. Defense attorneys asked her about the men who stole Jennifer's dog, Bowser, just weeks before her death. But Sherry said she didn't remember the police being told about this incident when she and Joe were interviewed the day after Jennifer's death. But then defense attorneys played a tape of Joe being interviewed about the canine thieves.
How I met Nate was they stole my boxer, okay? Oh, and he went out of the backyard and some people at Bucks stole him. This black guy named Paul Cut or something like that. Sherry's got his name. Okay, stole my dog, all right? I went back and got my dog physically. You know, there was three of them in the car. And at that point, I'm a pretty healthy man and I've been drinking. And I said, man, you give me back. Because Jennifer was crying and everything. And me and Fred were together. And Sherry was in the front seat, and I seen Bowser in a white Maverick, and a white Maverick's got crushed in back in. Like, it looks like they bumped into the utility pole. And when we pulled up there, Nate, we all hollered over to them because they were all standing up by the bar. I hollered over, I said, hey, man, has anybody seen a dog out here? Then Nate walked up to the car, and he said, yeah, man, we seen a dog. And your lady offered a reward, man. And how much you gonna pay for the reward? And I said, man, you know, I'm not gonna pay you anything for the reward, you know? I want my dog back, man. And we're going to have to do something about it right here and now. And Nate goes, "Oh man, no, be cool, man, be cool," you know. And so a little while later, we circled the block, and Nate stopped us. He said, "Hey man, I know where your dog's at, man. Just pull over there and park. Your dog will be here in just a few minutes. But these people are wanting money for your dog." All right. People pulled up in the white Maverick. I told Fred, "Block them off, man. There was a car behind him. We blocked him off." Fred Gonzalez. I jumped out of the car. I run around to the car window. The guy started to roll up the car window on the car. I grabbed a hold of the car window. I pulled the car window away from the window where it came all the way out of the hinges and rolled it up. And I reached inside, pulled it this way, reached inside with my dog and grabbed the dog and went in the back seat and said, "What the hell you doing, honky?" I said, "Man, I'm about ready to tear your head off if you don't get my dog out of here." And I grabbed my dog and I walked my dog back. I put the dog in the truck. We drove around to the house, okay? A week later, this Paul dude shows up with one of the guys that's in the car. Me and Fred are out in the backyard working on the car. He walks up with this tall, skinny black guy with these little bitty round silver glasses, okay? The landlords that I bought my house from are there at the time. Before they got there, the tall, skinny one with the round glasses, I told him, I said, "Man, you know, the best thing I can tell you guys is get the fuck out of my face, or I'm going to freak out right now in here, man. You know, if you want your reward for the dog, let's do it this way. Let's just totally fist fight about it and winner take all." And the one tall one split, you know. And Chris, they probably want to get a gun or something. And I said, "Man, who cares? We're going to go get it done, you know." And the one started talking. Then the people pulled up. The Pat dude pulled up, okay. Paul DePaul's, his name's Paul. And the people I bought my house from pulled up, and they're there witnessing it. This guy is threatening the shit out of me in my yard. I'm getting ready to knock him out, you know? And so I run him out into the street. I finally got tired of listening to his mouth, so I run him out into the street. And he got out in the street, he talked all kinds of shit. And he says, "Man, for you not paying me, honky, you better move because you're gonna pay, and you're gonna pay dearly for this." And he stormed off, and when he did that, I chased him down the Bucks, and he jumped in the car and split, you know? Okay. The next week, for like 5 days, the bus would pick Jennifer up. The asshole would chase Jennifer home from school from the bus stop. He'd chase her to the house from 12th Street to the bus stop. He'd see her. He'd take off chasing her, and she'd run to the house. And she said, "He's chasing her," and I'd go out and try to find him. He couldn't find me and stuff. And I was going to call the police on it, but I didn't, you know, because I had a warning at the time. I didn't want to jump, you know, I'll take care of this. If I'm not living in this neighborhood, I'm going to show this guy that they can't push me around. And so, and he did it for like 5 days. He stopped, he chased her home from school. And then I seen him again, and he drove by in a car, and he hollered at me. He says, "You're going to pay, honky. You are going to pay." And then he never chased her again, and we never have seen him in the neighborhood. But he's on that, our 11th Street's here, and then it's 7th Avenue, and 8th Avenue's right here. He's always on that block going to that liquor store and everything. I've never been able to catch up with him to do it because he always takes off running when he sees me. But he's somebody that tried to, you know, was going to do harm to Jennifer.
Here is why defense attorney Aaron Haubacher said this information is important.
The crux of our defense has been that this was a misguided and investigation targeted directly at Mr. Liggins to the exclusion of anybody else that might show that he was not the individual responsible for this. And in this case, they were given information, not only here, but an upcoming witness, in particular Officers Limbaum and Noon, about an individual who not only was threatening the family, but had taken specific actions and a pattern of actions to harass and to follow Jennifer Lewis, their child. And they did nothing to follow up on it, even though they were given a name and a description and a possible address, which comes up later through Mr. Glenn. It is extremely relevant to the defense and shows, again, the blinders that were on with law enforcement at the time.
So who killed Jennifer Lewis? Her stepdad, a band of dog thieves, or Stanley Liggins, the man on trial for her murder? These are some of the scenarios presented by the defense for jurors to be wrestling with when they begin deliberations Wednesday. Liggins' past attorney, Mike Toby, called this tactic a pasta bowl approach, where attorneys hope one of the glob of noodles they throw sticks.
I have to say, though, that Of all of the defense cases I have tried, and as you know, that's hundreds and hundreds, many times all I had was the pasta. And in my house, we threw it on the refrigerator, and if it stuck, it was done. I think that would probably make some sense as to how they went about presenting their defense.
One curious development was Sandy Ligon's decision not to testify. Jurors usually want to hear from the defendant. But the U.S. Constitution provides that no defendant can be compelled to testify. And Stanley Liggins has chosen not to testify in each of the three trials. Mike Toby, who represented Stanley Liggins in the second trial, said there are good reasons to keep him away from the witness stand.
I think I'm allowed to say without getting in trouble over, confidentiality, because it's obvious. If Stanley had ever said to me, Mike, I want to testify, he would have testified. It's his absolute right. And I would have done everything I could to help him put together a presentation that would be helpful before a jury.
So why do you think he wanted to testify? I mean, this was Stanley's decision, not the lawyers. What is it? Was it fear of his past convictions come in? Was it that he get caught into a verbal trap?
I don't think it was fear of his previous convictions, because he and I talked about that, and I felt he had a better than 50-50 shot that a judge would not allow a prior conviction or prior bad act evidence under the exceptions to the rule that you're not allowed to just show this person committed other crimes in the past or even similar crimes in the past. And that's in the Supreme Court of Iowa has always limited ordinary impeachment to crimes involving dishonesty, which include burglary, theft, forgery, and it includes robbery too, because theft is an element of robbery.
He's got a sexual abuse of a conviction.
Right. Now, the armed robbery could come in without it being a risk for the prosecution. His previous conviction. And the case law that I recall before I retired was that once the conviction was entered, even if you weren't sentenced yet, it could be used. And so that could have been his reasoning.
Folks, if you're anything like me, the word style kind of makes you uncomfortable. At least it does for me. I think of fancy models walking down runways wearing clothes that I would never be caught dead in. It's something, that I just don't do. I like clothes that are comfortable and fit well and are attractive. And that's why I really like this company called Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is an online personal styling service that finds and delivers clothes, shoes, and accessories to fit your body, budget, and lifestyle. Just go to stitchfix.com/suspect and tell them your sizes, what styles you like, and how much you want to spend on each item. You'll be paired with your very own personal stylist who will pick 5 items to send you right to your door. Then you'll try them on, pay only for what you love, and return the rest. Shipping, exchanges, and returns are always free. There's no subscription required. You can sign up to receive scheduled shipments or get your fix whenever you want. Stitch Fix styling fee is only $20, which is applied toward anything you keep from your first shipment. Get started now at stitchfix.com/suspect. You'll get an extra 25% off when you keep all 5 items in your box. That's stitchfix.com/suspect to get started today. One more time, folks. You'll absolutely love this company. Go to stitchfix.com/suspect. It's wonderful. You'll love it. I sure do.
I'm Benjamin Payne, reporter with WVIK Quad Cities NPR. Joining me now is Scott Reeder, who is in Waterloo, Iowa, covering the murder retrial of Stanley Liggins. Trial is now approaching 4 weeks of proceedings. Scott, thank you for taking the time to talk.
It's great to be here, Ben.
So how did proceedings wrap up today?
The defense rested, and Stanley Liggins chose not to testify. We heard the majority of the defense case for why they believe Stanley Liggins is innocent, and it was interesting.
And what are some theories that the defense has presented on who may have killed Jennifer Lewis?
Here's my theory. I would call this a spaghetti bowl defense. You know, a spaghetti bowl defense is when you take a bowl of spaghetti and you throw it against the wall and you see what sticks. There's three different theories or stories that you could go with if you want to look at alternate theories as to who killed Jennifer Lewis, if you're not going to believe that Stanley Liggins did. You could believe there's a woman that testified she was driving by that neighborhood that night, and she saw a man struggling to put a box in the back of a car, and other people were watching. And, you know, the theory is, could Jennifer have been in that box? And it was a white man, so could it have been her stepdad that was loading her into the box to take her someplace to set her on fire? Problem with that is there was no box found at the scene, no cardboard was incinerated, according to the experts that testified. Kind of a very questionable story. The next theory, which is kind of what the defense has honed in on, is whether Jennifer's stepfather could have killed her. Everybody who's been involved in this trial, on the defense, on the prosecution, the police, everybody will tell you that Jennifer's stepfather, Joe Glenn, is a total lowlife. I mean, he's somebody who has been in and out of jail. He's not an easy person to like. And in about, 7 or 8, 9 years after Jennifer's death, he got into an argument with some neighbors in the Fruitland Addition near Moline. And he supposedly hollered, you know, I killed my daughter and I'm not afraid to do the same thing to you. We had somebody testify to that today. And we had two people. We had a woman who had overheard him saying something to that effect, and we had the neighbor that was getting yelled at, was told that. At one point when that was presented, one of the jurors just absolutely gasped. But here's the thing. The police say Joe Glenn was the first person they looked at that night, because it's usually a family member who does something like this. But they say all of his time was accounted for, and he has an alibi the whole evening. So they say it couldn't have been Joe Glenn. And then the final theory that goes around, which is one I never heard before, and I probably know this case as well as anyone. The day after the murder, the police interviewed Joe Glenn and Sherry Glenn, Jennifer's mother and stepfather. And they told a story about Jennifer's dog being kidnapped and Joe getting into confrontation with the kidnappers and demanding the dog back. They wanted a ransom, and it went back and forth. And heard Joe tell it, he was the hero of the day and forcibly took the dog away. But he said that the people that they took the dog back from would follow Jennifer when she got off the bus each day. Never heard anything along those lines. I don't think it was presented in any of the other trials. So one of the questions the defense is like, well, why wasn't this looked into? Why did they focus right in on Stanley Liggins? Now, here's the thing. with it that nobody can answer that question on. The reason they focused in on Stanley Liggins was several reasons, but A, Stanley Liggins failed the polygraph test, which indicated to detectives that he may have been the person who committed the crime. Now, of course, polygraph tests are not admissible in court. B, Stanley Liggins was out on bond for sexually abusing another 9-year-old girl who, if you look at her picture, was almost identical in appearance to Jennifer Lewis. They could be sisters. And, you know, C, he had proximity to the family. He was seen with her that night several times. He was seen talking to her in a couple places before Jennifer disappeared. He was seen at the Max Liquor store where Jennifer was buying a pack of gum for Stanley Liggins. You know, that is why they focused in on him right away. And of course, jurors will never hear that he's been convicted of sexually abusing another 9-year-old girl. They'll never hear that he failed his polygraph test. So it looks a little bit like, if you don't have that background, it looks like, oh, those police, they just focused right in on this guy for no reason at all and then built the case from there. But there's a lot of things leading into it as well.
And speaking of the jurors, do you have any updates on the jury?
Well, yeah, it's rather strange. Two jurors have disappeared. And, you know, we started out the jury with three African-Americans out of the 12. And we had one person of mixed race. And we don't know what races that are in his mix, so I can't say whether he's part black or something else. But two of the African-American jurors are no longer on the jury. And we asked Judge Grieve after the jury was dismissed today, you know, what's going on here? You know, and she said, I cannot answer that question until after the trial's over. But, you know, it's concerning for a couple of reasons. One, I think the courts should be more transparent about what's going on, because when you hide things from the public, and I'm not getting on Judge Grieve's case about this, I think she's just following the rules, but it causes people to distrust the system. But the other issue is, this is a case that's had major league racial overtones from day one. Jennifer Lewis was white. Stanley Liggins, the defendant, is black. His first two juries, you know, he's being retried a third time. The first two juries were all white. And in fact, in the first jury that we won in Davenport, Iowa, they had a South African white man who'd immigrated to Iowa, who expressed some racial supremacy thoughts to WVIK and suspect convictions. So when you have that kind of history and who's deciding on whether Stanley Liggins is guilty or innocent, and then suddenly out of the blue, two of the three black people on the jury disappear, it raises concerns. Maybe they aren't legitimate concerns, but you want racial diversity on a jury because you want a jury of your peers. You want a cross-section of the community making a wise decision. So that's concerning.
Now, you've done a lot of court reporting, not just in this case, but many others. What could have possibly happened to those jurors?
You know, it could be a lot of things. It could be one of them had a family member suddenly fall ill and they needed to leave town. It could be somebody broke the rules and expressed an opinion on the case before the deliberations began. I sure think it would be a strong temptation to express your opinion. I mean, if you spend 3.5 weeks sitting in a trial listening to all this graphic testimony and looking at these horrible pictures of a burned child. And, you know, wouldn't it be, if you're sitting there with all these other people going through the same experience, wouldn't it be tempting just to kind of say, you know, I think he's innocent or I think he's guilty. But if you do that, you can get booted off the jury. So it could be something like that. It could be the person, the juror herself is having a health issue. It's a man and a woman that have disappeared from the jury. We just don't know why. And, you know, that's a question that really needs to get resolved. And I think we should make a point of reporting on when the trial is over. I mean, be able to ask, why were these people dismissed?
And is there a minimum number of jurors that are needed in order to deliberate?
Good question. Well, they start with 12 jurors and 3 alternates. We're now down to 13 people. None of them know who the alternate is amongst them. I happen to have a good source that told me that the 3 African-Americans were jurors, not alternates. But people in the jury box don't know whether they're an alternate or a juror. But one of those people will be dismissed when deliberations begin tomorrow. And the other 12 will be going into a room and trying to hash it out amongst themselves.
And so that will be happening on Wednesday. Closing arguments are expected?
Yes, they're going to be doing closing arguments. They're going to give jury instructions tomorrow morning. And the defense and the prosecution will each make their closing arguments. And I'm guessing somewhere around noon, the jury goes into a room and starts pondering guilt or innocence.
Okay. Was there anything else you want to mention, Scott?
No, it's a fascinating case. I can say that Standing Liggins was all smiles today when the defense rested. Apparently, he's pleased with how things are going. I can say that jurors looked relieved, like, hey, this is coming to an end, and now we see the light at the end of the tunnel. Hopefully it's not the headlight of an oncoming train, but, you know, they're seeing that maybe there's an end coming to this trial. This has been an enormous commitment of time for them, and, you know, that's concerning. And, you know, the other thing to keep in mind with a jury is some employers are very generous and provide pay to jurors, but many employers don't. You know, a lot of small businesses can't afford to do that. And so some of these jurors may not be getting paid for a month because they got called jury service. So there's a huge sacrifice on their part.
All right. Well, thanks for your time, Scott.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Minna from True Crime Finland. Ah, Finland, so peaceful and safe. There isn't even any crime there, right? Wrong. Join me every 2 weeks in discovering the dark side of the Land of a Thousand Lakes. Everything from human trafficking and Ponzi schemes to double homicide and child abuse. From the forgotten and lesser known to the legendary and infamous Finnish cases, the podcast will be sure to offer something for everyone. You can find True Crime Finland on iTunes, Pocket Casts, Podcast Addict, or wherever you get your podcasts.